threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the most fascinating works of history I've ever had the pleasure to read is The Lord of the Rings. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, and yes, I said history. Our guest makes the case that while there are some works of historical fiction that will fictionalize actual events in history, there are some works of fiction that are so historical in their approach that they might almost be considered history. Our guest is a student of history, specifically Islamic history. Call him a scholar rather than a student, I should say. He served in the 101st Airborne as an Arabic linguist and then later as a Christian chaplain. He's a regular commentator on news media, most recently on the Fox Business Network as part of the Oliver North series War Stories. He's the author of the books 10 Years Fascination with the Mahdi's Camps, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate, Holiest Wars, Islamic Mahdis, Their Jihads, and Osama bin Laden. But for today, we set all of that aside to talk about his new book, High Towers and Strong Places, A Political History of Middle Earth. Welcome, Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, it's good to talk with you again.
Glad to be back, Derek.
Boy, this is a book that when you first announced the title, my wife and I are both excited about this. She'll get to read it as soon as I'm done with it. Of course, she's in the middle of writing her own stuff right now anyway. Anytime I ask her to do anything that's outside of the realm of Victorian London, which is where her story is set, it's really an imposition. But she is looking forward to reading this as well. First of all, as a student or scholar of history yourself, what was it that prompted you to apply the analysis that we would apply to historical chronicles to the works of J.R.R. Tolkien?
Well, that was not my original aim. As I say in the acknowledgments in this book, which inexplicably are at the back, but it's a very wonderfully put together book. The original intent was to write a military history of Middle Earth, which, by the way, I am writing right now.
Ah.
It's going to be called Bright Swords and Glorious Warriors, : A Military History of Middle Earth. And that was the original. It was originally going to be just one volume. And I had decided that this would be something that I wanted to do some years ago, actually probably 7 or 8 years ago, maybe. I taught college history for a while, world and Middle East history, and I've been a Tolkien fan, as I say in the introduction to this book, since I was 16, which was, let's see, I think the year Jimmy Carter got elected. I may date myself. I've always been a huge Tolkien fan, and I've been one of these Tolkien fans that I was always more interested in sort of the grand geopolitical things going on and the wars. You know, the whole thing with Gollum and the fact that he got corrupted by the ring and the whole, you know, suffering servant sort of thing that you get with Frodo, mm-hmm. which is undeniable. I mean, that's very interesting, but I found more interesting, you know, the wars and the grand strategy and how do you stop Sauron and the weaponry and that sort of thing. And then eventually I read The Silmarillion and the other Tolkien's works, and you find that wars are pretty endemic throughout Tolkien's writings.
Mm-hmm.
Because as, a lot of folks may not know, but The Lord of the Rings is like toward the end of the history that Tolkien wrote. There's at least 7,000 years of history, according to his own source material that he created before The Lord of the Rings. I looked at a lot of that stuff, and I was very interested in it historically. I mean, I was kind of the nerdy kid and then adult that would read the appendices. I would sit around and read the appendices, which if your listeners have never read to Tolkien, they're very, very important, and they're actually very interesting. The appendices, Lord of the Rings, even aside from Tolkien's other stuff. And then a few years ago, I taught a few courses on military history. I had not done that before for American Military University, and I had never formally studied military history as a discipline. My fields, when I did my PhD, were Islamic, Middle Eastern, African, and world history. So I'd never formally done military history. So, excuse me, I had to do some kind of catch up on that, and I read a number of books on the different modes of warfare and strategy and tactics and so on and so forth. And, you know, until the advent of firearms, and actually even after firearms were invented around, you know, 1000, 1100 AD and became, you know, eventually supplanted swords and bladed weapons, there were basically just four modes of warfare: heavy infantry, heavy cavalry, light cavalry, and combinations thereof. I guess you could argue there also were some aspects of things like biological warfare and unconventional warfare and such. But basically, in terms of battles between empires and states and such, that's what you had. And then, of course, you know, I'd watched Lord of the Rings movies, and I rewatched them with my sons. And then my sons and I got into Lord of the Rings Risk. So I got to thinking, someone should write a military historical analysis of Tolkien's world, not just the ones and not just the battles that people know of from the movies, which again are just late Third Age in his chronology, but the ones that are described in Tolkien's appendices and his other writings that go way back thousands of years before Lord of the Rings. So a friend who recently actually just died last year, a fellow named Jeff Murray, who lived down here in near Atlanta, not far from me, who's an artist. If you don't know Jeff Murray's stuff, go look it up. J-E-F-1-F and Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y. He did a lot of, he was a very staunch Catholic, very pious man, died abruptly of a heart attack last year. He did many, many like calendars, Middle-earth style calendars and artwork. And you can still purchase his stuff, I believe. But Jeff and I met, and I pitched the idea to him because I knew he knew some publishers, and he said, oh, that's a great idea. So he put me in contact with Oloris Publishers out of Toronto. And again, the original idea was to be a military history of Middle Earth, and so I got to work on it. And then I realized before I could get into describing the two dozen battles that I picked out from the first through the early Fourth Age of Middle Earth to analyze, I had to set the stage with the political actors and the kingdoms and all that sort of stuff. And that part, to steal a line from Tolkien, that tale grew in the telling to the point that it got so voluminous that my publisher said, break that out into a separate book. So that's what this is, the book that you're looking at there, and hopefully your listeners, some of them will look at, High Towers and Strong Places, is the political part of that. And there's a few more elements to it. I also analyze, as I say, particularly in the third chapter here, I look at anthropological, cultural, even some economic stuff as much as I can in terms of the various entities, polities, and races in Middle Earth. And then I analyze them in terms of, in the earlier chapters, in terms of what types of governments are they? I mean, they're not all just simply monarchies. And I basically sort of look at it as ancient history, and I try to fit it into different paradigms of political analysis and also international relations analysis.
You write in the introduction that Tolkien differs from other fantasy writers like George R. R. Martin, Ursula Le Guin, Robert Jordan, Stephen Donaldson, because their stories are not set in this planet's past, meaning Earth's past. Mm-hmm. And a point that you say that receives short shrift in the criticism. So you're saying then that Tolkien and his Middle Earth was actually set consciously by Tolkien in Earth's distant past.
Yes, he specifically says that. And he also says at one point, and a lot of this he says in his letters that were published separately some years after his death, that his very voluminous letters that he wrote to not just his son, but other people, publishers and friends, he says that if you had to try to date, like he says, for instance, if you dated the fall of Sauron, it would be approximately 4000 BC. So, but then he sort of caveats this by saying he's identified a specific time, but not really a specific place, except that it's in our world, you know, and he also embellishes. And I guess in a sense sort of caveats by saying that although there are elements of, as he calls it, fairy, F-A-I-E-R-I-E, I guess, instead of F-A-I-R-Y, you know, with the elves and things like that, that it's very much our own world, you know. People still walk under the sunlight, the trees are the same, the water's the same, you know, the flora and fauna's basically the same, you know, with a few exceptions, like dragons.
Yeah.
but he basically says he's trying to write about a period that he calls the process of these millennia in his history of myth becoming history. And you go from mythical times to historical times. And what I'm trying to get at is sort of that juncture where it takes place, because a lot of what he talks about, and it's clear, I think, and this has never really been written about before that anybody that I know of, if you read the appendices, probably like 2/3 of the appendices of Lord of the Rings deal with the history of Gondor. Mm-hmm. Gondor sort of serves the role of Rome in his world.
Hmm. Okay.
And it's where history really, or myth becomes history. And you go from, and as they talk, they make allusion to this in the an actual specific mention of this in the movies, what's called the Dominion of Men. You go from the period when there are other sentient races like the elves and the dwarves and even the hobbits, who, by the way, are not actually a separate race, but they're actually just a smaller version of men. We can
right.
talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
But these other races die out or go away, and then what you're left with at the end when you get into historical time is really only men, humans. And, of course, Tolkien uses men to mean men and women. So, that's kind of what I was getting at with this, and I just find it very fascinating that he takes such pains to make, I mean, as a lot of people have observed, he takes such pains to make the world so real. And I think part of the reason he can do that is because he, at least semi-consciously, is embedding it in our ancient past and not creating an entirely separate, you know, work like some of these other fantasy writers did.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and you found the books and were drawn into Tolkien's world as a teen. In my teen years, I was reading hard science fiction. I preferred writers like Larry Niven, Jerry Purnell.
I was reading that too, Derek.
Yeah,
I think The Moten God's Eye may be the best science fiction book ever written.
Amen. Amen.
And someone needs to make a movie of it.
Yes, absolutely. And the Known Space series, I read everything in the Known Space series that Niven ever wrote.
I read all the Dune books, including the prequels and sequels.
Now, I read 3 of the Dune books, but by the 3rd book, I was beginning to get a little bored with it. I thought,
we're trying to out-geek each other here, aren't we?
Yeah. Putting our credentials out there. But
Robert Heinlein, are you a Heinlein guy?
I read Starship Troopers about the time the movie came out. So I read it before the movie. But not a big Heinlein guy. No.
Glory Road. If you have never read Glory Road, it's just one fantasy book.
Make a note of that.
Reading hard stuff, you said.
Yeah, but my point was that I never read Lord of the Rings because I knew a bunch of people in high school who did. And uh-huh. they were always emphasizing the fantasy elements of it, you know, the elves and the dwarves and stuff. And the writers of that stuff, they cheat by bringing in magic and stuff. And of course, that's not what Tolkien does.
Right.
But I avoided the Lord of the Rings for that reason until the first movie came out. And Sharon, God love her, she's had an awful lot of patience with me through the years. she was more like you. She found it early and has read them often. Mm-hmm. She got our daughter to read when the first movie came out. And I forget when it came out, but I know that we had to pull her out of elementary school in order to go see it the first day it opened. So Nicole got a much earlier introduction to the books than I did. I didn't read them until the movies were about to come out. And that's when I discovered I'd been missing it for years because I assumed that all of these derivative works that just built upon the world that Tolkien created. I mean, he essentially has created the pattern for most of the fantasy work that's come since then. So, I denied myself some really, really, stuff I could have been reading in my high school years that was better than some of the stuff that I did read. Mm-hmm. Now, having said all that, is it because, I mean, how did Tolkien's experience in the real world, for example, a soldier in World War I, inform his writing? There are some who criticize the books and especially the movies because Jackson really emphasizes the martial element in his films. Mm-hmm. How did Tolkien's experience in war translate into The Lord of the Rings?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with it. I didn't focus on that. There are a number of other people that have actually focused on that. Janet Brennan Croft, who's a writer that's written on Tolkien specifically and his experiences in World War I and how they affected him. famously, they said, what was it? He said by the time he was 22 or something like that, all but one of his friends was dead.
Mm.
He fought in the trenches and he was an officer. So he was greatly affected by that. And people have speculated, I think. He I read all of his letters and everything biographical I could find about him. He never really said a lot about that. I think a lot of that is supposition for instance, his views of the dead marshes, it has something to do with the trench warfare and that sort of thing. And you can kind of draw out allusions from things that he says. But beyond the fact that I think he had a firsthand experience of war, and particularly seems to he also spent quite a bit of time working in signals. So he seems to have become a big fan of making his own maps, for instance. Beyond that, I don't really delve into that much because I think it presupposes trying to sort of read his mind, and it's hard to read the mind of a guy that's dead. The direction I go in is that, I think you're exactly right. Jackson took some flack, particularly from the folks that are sort of the, the real hardcore sort of fantasy fans that mm-hmm. want to stay in, Rivendell.
Exactly. Yeah. Show more of the feast.
How exactly do elves get their hair like that? Those sort of folks, of which there are many, and I understand that, but those I think sort of from that direction, you've gotten criticism, as you said, of him for emphasizing war. But, the book is about a war. And again, much of Tolkien's writings are about wars. The Silmarillion is about wars against Morgoth, who was basically the Satan figure in Middle Earth's legendarium. Sauron was simply his, assistant. In the First Age, Morgoth was basically Satan incarnate on Earth, and the elves were fighting against him. Not always for very altruistic reasons. They had their own reasons. He stole these, according to Tolkien. He stole these three famous jewels called the Silmarils
mm-hmm.
from Fëanor, who was the first great elf artisan, who probably also created the Palantir, the crystal ball seeing stones,
mm-hmm.
Which are still around 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 years later. But the elves had their reasons for fighting him, and he created orcs and goblins and fought these. I would say they're apocalyptic. They're apocalyptic, and I guess in the sense of being very horrible, but they didn't end the world wars. And then the Second Age, Tolkien has three ages, first, second, and third. The Second Age is very much the tale of the Atlantis-like civilization of men called the Numenoreans,
mm-hmm.
from which in the Third Age, Gondor and the vanished kingdom of Arnor, which is where Aragorn and his people were from, those were simply colonies of Numenor. But in the Second Age, it's Numenor against Sauron, and they defeat him twice, handily. And it's wars. I mean, in the Third Age, as we know, besides, the Third Age, according to Tolkien, ends in the year 3019 of the Third Age, or three millennia of the Third Age. And as I point out in the book, in that period, Gondor fights at least five major wars. It's a major war every 500 years. So it's very much about wars. It's not just about wars, but it's certainly as much about, if not more about wars than it is about hobbits sitting around smoking pipes, which, I like that stuff. I smoke pipes myself. So that's kind of a criticism that is unfortunate, but I point out I don't know if you've read that part or not, but I point out in the introduction that, yeah, there's kind of two kinds of people that like Tolkien, and one really likes the hobbits and the Hobbiton and the pipe smoking
comparisons of
comparisons
of various the virtues of various types of pipeweed. Yeah,
right, and all that implies. And then there's the folks that like the wars, and you could be both, I think. But I think that. The former has really been overemphasized. And again, I did a great deal of bibliographical research. And, it should probably no surprise to anyone, but if you look at the bibliographies, and I looked at places like the Journal of Tolkien Studies and other other bibliographies for English literature and analysis, but you know, 90+%, probably more like 97-98% of the books and articles written about Tolkien since The Lord of the Rings came out in the 1950s have been basically literary criticism. Something about the influence of Sigurd on the dragon and the ring cycle of Wagner, or the literary critical concepts, stuff that, as I point out in the introduction, I have no clue and I am not even close in any wise qualified to discuss that stuff. Okay, my point is like as I used the example of the dragon Smaug, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to know if he was influenced by the dragons in the Ring of the Valkyries or St. George's dragon or any of that stuff. I just want to know if there's a large flying reptile that breathes fire, how the hell do you kill it?
Sure. Yeah.
That's what I want to know. I mean, I'm looking at it like this is a weapon. This is a problem you have to deal with.
Right.
So that's how I'm looking at it. So, it's just saying, assuming that there's a world in which dragons exist, how do you kill one?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm coming from. Assuming that there's a world in which there are evil daemons like Morgoth and Sauron who can basically telepathically command minions, hundreds of thousands of minions that have only one purpose in life, which is to kill you, how do you defeat them? So that's what I'm looking at.
Yeah,
it's sort of prosaic in that sense.
Well, exactly. And I think the reason that this hasn't been done before, because most of the guys who have an interest in that sort of analysis are probably too busy out at the gun range to read, the Ring Cycle or the Beowulf saga.
This has taken away from my range time, too.
Yes, and I appreciate that.
And my fencing time, so yes.
Yeah. You mentioned Rome as sort of a pattern, or Gondor at least, as sort of an analog of Rome in mm-hmm. the Tolkien cycle. I found myself most interested in the Rohirrim, the Riders of Rohan. And I think we share a favorite character, because I love the character of Theoden and the way he's redeemed at the end. His final speech, when I see it on screen, when I read it, where he's talking to Eowyn, it just makes me weep.
When he's dying?
Yes. The actor who portrayed the role did a wonderful job with
Bernard
the
Hill.
Role.
Bernard Hill, who, by the way, was also the captain in Titanic.
Yes. That's another film that I've managed to miss because it just...
me too. I can't watch it all.
Strikes me as a chick flick, and that's...
I was rooting for DiCaprio to drown, but...
Thankfully, I'm married to a woman who's more interested in watching, say, the new installment in the Alien cycle, the franchise.
Married.
Yeah. I know it.
But Bernard Hill, he should have gotten an Oscar for that movie.
Yes, he should have. That was wonderful. And Jackson, to his credit, I think has staged in the films some of the most magnificent battle scenes.
Oh, exactly.
Ever.
I totally agree.
The only ones that come close for my money is the movie from, I think it was 1964, Michael Caine's first film, Zulu.
I have never seen Zulu.
Battle of Rourke's Drift.
I need to see that. Yeah.
Oh, my.
No, I've just never seen it.
Oh, well, yeah. Do see it, because the final confrontation between the tribes and the small contingent of Welsh infantry holding this little outpost is just absolutely spectacular. Anyway, what are some of the other cultures that we can identify, or at least have it make a good guess at what inspired Tolkien? I mean, what is the pattern for Rohan? What is the pattern for the men of the Haradrim? Who is he drawing on for those?
Yeah, that's a good question. Gondor and Arnor are sort of the Roman Empire, the Eastern and Western Roman Empire, except they're sort of Northern and Southern in this case. Again, Gondor and Arnor are founded at the end of the Second Age by Numenor. Numenor was the great human civilization that is clearly modeled on Atlantis that was destroyed. By the way, let me back up and explain that. And of all of the three ages that I just talked about, Tolkien probably has less on the Second Age. The First Age is the one with the elves coming to Middle Earth and fighting, again, the satanic Morgoth figure. The Third Age is, of course, the one that ends with the War of the Ring, and it's Sauron. The Second Age is one, Tolkien even says in his letters, there's much less on that than anything else, but I managed to tease out quite a bit. The Second Age is dominated, again, by the human kingdom of Numenor, which is somewhat like Atlantis, which is, becomes the most powerful kingdom in the world. It's a great seafaring empire. They twice defeat Sauron on their own without help from anybody else. And in fact, they save the elves' bacon, if I can mix my metaphors, because the elves are about to get overrun and destroyed by Sauron in the Second Age when these 7-foot-tall men show up and save them. But Numenor winds up getting corrupted by Sauron. They defeat him in battle. I shouldn't even say they defeat him in battle. They show up with a huge army, and all of his armies run away. And Sauron is left by himself. Now, Sauron is a divine figure. He's basically, in Tolkien's legendarium, Sauron is an angel, an angelic figure, whereas Morgoth would have been an archangelic figure, mm-hmm. Lucifer, right? Sauron, basically, and the wizards that come later in the Third Age are more or less the same level as Sauron, although far less powerful because they haven't spent thousands of years practicing evil. But Gandalf and Saruman are basically originally sort of the same level as Sauron. So Sauron is a divine figure who can't actually be killed in the same way that, you know, a person could.
Right.
But anyway, the Numenoreans defeat him, defeat his armies, take him back as a prisoner to Numenor, which is this big island kingdom out west of Middle-earth. And within 60 years, he's talked them into stopping the worship of the one god in Tolkien's legendarium, Eru,
mm-hmm.
because they were basically monotheists, and worshiping Morgoth, the satanic mm-hmm. figure. And then they build up this big armada that they had, and they sail off to Valinor, which is the place where the elves, you know, sail to at the end of Lord of the Rings.
Right.
To go oversee. Well, Sauron convinces the Numenorean king to that if he conquers Valinor, men will be immortal.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not true, but he does. And then as a consequence, God destroys the Atlantean kingdom, the Numenorean kingdom. Now, out of the survivors of that, this guy Elendil, which you see briefly at the start of the Lord of the Rings movies, who's killed by Sauron.
Mm-hmm.
And they create two kingdoms out of the colonies that were there, Gondor and Arnor. Sorry to throw that in, but I had to explain that. So Gondor and Arnor, basically, Arnor is sort of the Western Roman Empire. It eventually is destroyed. It goes mm-hmm. away. All that's left of Gondor, of Arnor, I should say, in the north of Middle-earth, is Aragorn and his people, sort of wandering rangers, but who nonetheless maintain a legitimate line to the throne. Gondor is the Eastern Roman Empire, if you will. It's Byzantium,
mm-hmm.
and it survives. And in much the same way, it fights against the invaders from the east and the south, you know, the nomadic hordes. And then eventually, as you point out with the Haradrim are clearly modeled on North African Moors,
mm-hmm.
People from the Sahara area who had attacked north. That's a lot of what I talk about, because I think Gondor is very, very important and really sort of gets short shrift in Tolkien's writings. So that's a big part of it. And then I talk about the whole idea of kingship and restoration of legitimate rulership and what constitutes legitimate rulership. And again, as I said, I talk about different kinds of kingdoms in Middle-earth. You could argue maybe a couple of them are sort of proto-democratic, a lot of monarchies. You got theocracies, you got mm-hmm. aristocracies and all this sort of thing. So there's that. Then you have, of course, the elves, and it's really hard to sort of explain the political systems that the elves have. By the time you get to the Third Age, early in the First Age, in the first part of this, they're clearly simply sort of feudal monarchies. By the time you get to Third Age, thousands of years later, they are really more sort of like aristocracies. You could even argue that they're sort of benevolent dictatorships in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about the fact that in a world where there are beings that live for thousands of years, as the elves do, you would have a different political system than you would where, you know, in Gondor, where men live, if you're lucky, to 100. Unless you are, of course, Numenorean descended. Important issue, the Numenoreans, at one point, the first king of Numenor was half man, half elf.
Mm-hmm.
His descendants were given long life. This is why, for instance, Aragorn lives. You know, the scene in the extended edition where they find out, Eowyn finds out that Aragorn's like 87 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And he lives, if you read Tolkien in the appendices, Aragorn lives to 210
mm-hmm.
after he's king for 120 years. But that strain that came into humanity from the elves eventually dies out, and so the longevity goes to normal. But for normal people that aren't descended from the Numenoreans, you know, 80, 100 years, same sort of thing. So you have very different institutions. I mean, Tolkien talks about, for instance, with the elves, that although there were some sort of like Rivendell, you know, the Rivendell with Elrond in the movies, see books and manuscripts there and such. But that wasn't the primary means. Tolkien specifically says this in some of his other writings. The primary means by which the elves remembered the past was it was in their heads.
Yeah, they saw it.
They had lived for thousands of years. They were basically like living repositories of lore. Contrast that, of course, with what do you have? What's the main kingdom of Middle-earth? It's Gondor. And remember the scene where Gandalf rides off to Gondor and he starts looking through the archives. Yes, because Minas Tirith, which was the main city of Middle-earth, you know, sort of the Constantinople, if you will, they had humans don't live for thousands of years. So you don't pass on knowledge the same way. You have to have, like we have in our real world, you have to have libraries and scrolls and things. So it's very different like that.
Yeah. And when you live for thousands of years, you don't have issues of succession, not nearly as often anyway as you would in a human kingdom.
Yes. And that's why Elrond can hang around and rule Rivendell for, you know, thousands of years. And Thranduil, who shows up in the Hobbit movies, of course, Legolas's father, you know, he rules that kingdom in Mirkwood for, you know, 3,000-4,000 years. So, yeah, it's very different. Now, the dwarves are sort of in between. I deal with the dwarves. The dwarves live not as long as elves, but longer than humans. Average lifespan's like 250 years, according to Tolkien. So, and they have kingdoms themselves. You see that some in The Hobbit, of course, with, you know, is Thorin going to become king of Erebor? You know, and then the issue of Moria and that sort of thing. But if you go back and unpack Tolkien's writings, again, there are other multi-volume things that a lot of people don't look at. He talks about that there were originally 7 or 8 dwarf kingdoms. Excuse me, they were clearly monarchies. And the dwarves have this weird thing of like reincarnation of their first ruler, a guy called Durin.
Yeah.
Durin basically was reincarnated every so often in a ruler with like basically it seems to say his same exact memories and such. So dwarves are quite different. And I unpack some of that. Dwarvish culture is very interesting because, I mean, look, I love Jackson's movies. I love them. I watch them over and over.
Yeah.
In fact, my sons and I just said when school's out here in a few weeks, we got to do the extended editions all again on a weekend.
Yeah. Sharon and I are planning on doing the same thing when we get a spare weekend coming up here. We just got those from Amazon here a couple of weeks ago.
Leave the house for the weekend. But, but like, there are things that he just gets wrong. And look, I'm one of these people. I'm one of these people that let me back up. There are a lot of people now, younger people than us, Derek. You're interesting in being your age and only having read Tolkien at this point. There are a lot of younger people that never read the books.
Right.
They have only come to Tolkien's world through the movies, which is great. But it's funny because they will get sometimes a little hot under the collar when you point out that, well, that's not what it's like in Tolkien's world. Well, who cares? Well, I would say that since the man created the world, his works are the canon. Some people hate that.
Yeah.
C-A-N-O-N, right? But that's what I go by. So, for instance, you know, look, one of the best characters in all of the movies is Gimli, right? There's no doubt. And I always say, I'll take Gimli over any of the dwarves in the Hobbit movies, unfortunately, because they were all not very nice, except for maybe Beaufort. but he was funny. But Gimli, I mean, John Rhys Davies did such a great job with Gimli. He was awesome. But for instance, Tolkien specifically says in one of his works called Peoples of Middle-earth, he has a very long chapter on the dwarves. He says that dwarves no dwarf would ever ride a horse or a pony, ever. And he goes on to say not only that, but they never domesticated any animals. They were the only race in Middle-earth that never domesticated any animals. And then I talk about the fact that how do you have a civilization, how do you have a culture where you have no domesticated animals?
Right.
So, you know, there are ramifications that come from that. So, that's something I'm like, oh my gosh, why did Jackson have to do that? It changes things. And so, again, the book is written on the basis that what Tolkien himself wrote is, again, authoritative. And I mentioned the movies, and again, I love the movies, but some of these departures, you know, really sort of change things. But then, ramifications come from that. Like the dwarves, clearly, I talk about the fact that they are, you know, supreme metallurgists and engineers. They are very sort of isolationist. They don't really get along well with elves. They get along well with men, okay. What was my other point? They're very warlike. I mean, but they're, you know, part of their warlike nature is limited by the fact that they're only 5 foot tall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is another thing we're Tolkien. Okay. So Tolkien in the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, you had a lot of people won't get this unless you read Tolkien. There's a difference between orcs or goblins and these Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the movie, remember when Boromir is killed and he's about when, and then Aragorn shows up and has that fight with the Uruk-hai, Lurtz, I believe it is, and kills him by beheading him. I mean, that he's what, like 6'3" or something?
Yeah.
6'2". I mean, and then in the Hobbit movies, you have all of these orcs, especially the one, what's his name, Azog.
Yeah.
Who's like, I don't know, he must be 6'4". I mean, this is just ludicrous, besides the fact that the orcs in Lord of the Rings were like not actually, they were actually people in makeup, not CGI, which made them look so much better. But for instance, Tolkien points out that only the Uruk-hai were almost man high, which means they were almost 6 foot tall because your average man's 6 foot tall.
Right.
People like Aragorn are much taller because he's, again, a descendant of Numenoreans, and so he's like 6.5 foot tall. And goblins, which are regular orcs, are the same size as dwarves. So, you know, by making them like so big, it really sort of changes things a lot, especially when you're trying to deal with something like, you know, weaponry and battle formations and stuff, as I'm grappling with in this next book. I mean, I get into a little bit of this in this book, especially in the third chapter. I mean, part of, you know, what kind of weapons you use in battle, part of it's dependent on just simply how big you are.
Right.
So I deal with that sort of thing. And, you know, again, I'm coming at it from the point of view, which I think is quite logical, which is that Tolkien's writings are authoritative on this. And I made comments about the movies. And again, I love the movies, but I just, there are things that Peter Jackson changed that I didn't think he needed to. I mean, some things you have to change. Like Aragorn, you know, in the movies, when they meet Aragorn, he's carrying around a broken sword.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not going to do you much good when you're fighting in the wild.
Right.
You probably want a real sword, you know. But I mean, so that kind of works in a book, but it really is not going to work in the movie. I can understand that. You know, the broken sword is at that shrine at Rivendell, and right. Aragorn is another sword. That's okay. I'm okay with that. But, you know, some of the other stuff he changed, I simply don't get. And I point this out in the book.
Yeah. And you're right. That was something that in the movie getting drawn in, it's not something that occurred to me until later, but you're right. The size of the orcs was inflated in the films, which made them that much more ominous, I suppose, from a storytelling standpoint. But it does then beg credulity. It defies credulity when you look at these poor people, you know, the refugees from Lake Town trying to defend themselves, actually rallying against these guys that are way bigger. Armored.
They didn't even have any armor.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't make any sense.
Wiped out in about 5 minutes.
Right. In any real fight.
Right.
Yeah. So you're right. Although I will say that eliminating we watched the extended version of the Battle of the Five Armies as soon as we got it, because our favorite scene in I think all of the movies is when Dane arrives on the scene. Good morning. How are we all?
Right.
Yeah. Which is Billy Connolly was wonderful in that, and having him show up on foot just wouldn't have been quite as
I know. So they put on War Pigs.
Yeah,
which I wonder
pig.
Why they didn't play the Black Sabbath song. But
yeah,
you know, yeah. I love him. And by the way, you know, they show this in the extended edition, but on the regular, he becomes the king.
Right,
of
Erebor. Right,
yeah.
Right,
yeah, King Dane the First. Right.
So that was neat. And of course, then the scene where they, you know, the sled that being pulled by the battle rams or whatever they call
that
it.
That was great.
But that was pretty awesome. But again, yeah.
Just let me say something about that real quick, Derek. There's a scene there where, you know, when they show up and Thranduil tells the elves, he says something in Elvish, okay? And then the elves go into this like sort of battle phalanx right thing.
Yeah.
He tells them, form a Thangale, okay? And this is, this is such good stuff. I'm going to cover this at length in, of course, the military history book, which I'm writing now. A Thangale, Thangail, was a Numenorean battle formation, and Tolkien describes it in detail in one of the stories in Unfinished Tales. It's interestingly enough, it's the story of how Isildur was killed at the end of the war after he had the ring and the ring fell into the river, you know. But it's the only place in all of Tolkien's writings. It's about a 17-page essay chapter in Unfinished Tales where he describes actual battle formations in detail. But it's interesting that somebody had done their homework and had the Elven King say that. It's interesting that, you know, would the elves use a battle formation that humans used? But they might have. So anyway, that's the kind of thing I'm doing.
Well, looking forward to seeing the follow-up book when it's ready later this year or early next, Bright Swords and Glorious Warriors, A Military History of Middle-earth. The book we've been discussing, High Towers and Strong Places, A Political History of Middle-earth. And where do people find a copy of the book?
You can go, it's on Amazon right now, Amazon.com. It's also on Books A Million, and it's also on Barnes & Noble.
All right. Excellent. I've got my copy on the Kindle. And like I said, as soon as Sharon can take a break from her writing, I know she's going to want to dig into this. I've been working my way through the Silmarillion for a while, and I keep getting distracted by other things. But I know Sharon has read through the Silmarillion and Unfinished Tales and the footnotes and the additional material. So I've got some catching up to do yet. But like I said, it wasn't until about 15 years ago that I actually started reading the works of Tolkien. I've been through the trilogy twice, been through The Hobbit twice, there's so much there that, you know, obviously here we are, what, 60 years after they were first published, and there's still more to be teased out, pulled out from these books?
Right. I mean, the first one came out in 54. Of course, The Hobbit came out, what, 37 or 38, I think it was. Mm. And of course, you know, a couple things have been published since then. Children of Húrin came out a few years ago. Mm. If you don't know that one, Húrin was the first age human warrior. And it's a very depressing tale if you want to read it. But Húrin and the story of his son Turin, who helped the elves fight against Morgoth. It's a very depressing tale, heroic but depressing. I mean, very sort of Norse in that regard.
Mm. And very quickly, because I know you're up against the clock here. The Kingdom of Rohan. Did he base that upon Norse sagas, or was that more of an Anglo-Saxon type thing?
Yeah, it's sort of a combo. And I'm sorry, you mentioned Rohan earlier, and I went off on tangents. Rohan sort of serves as a client kingdom. Vis-a-vis Gondor, it's sort of like some of the client, quote-unquote, barbarian kingdoms were vis-a-vis Rome.
Yeah.
And you find out, of course, in the books, that Theoden actually was born in Gondor. You know, some of the families of Rohan would spend time in Gondor because they were such good allies. And Theoden's wife, who, of course, has died by the time of the movies, was actually from Gondor. But they serve the purpose of sort of like the noble barbarian pagans vis-a-vis Rome. That's sort of the place Rohan has in this world.
Okay. That's kind of what I thought. The federati, the tribes that would accept payment from Byzantium or from Rome in order to secure the borders.
Right.
Until such time as they decided to collect the taxes directly.
Right.
Dr. Timothy Furnish, the author of High Towers and Strong Places, A Political History of Middle-earth. Tim, thanks for your time, and I look forward to getting through this and then eagerly awaiting the next one.
Thank you, Derek.
Dr. Timothy Furnish's website is mahdiwatch.org, mahdiwatch.org. There'll be a link to that. And in the show notes, I also put links to the various places you can find a copy of the new book, Strong Places and High Towers, A Political History of Middle-earth. I'm really enjoying it because it's collates a lot of information from various sources that Tolkien published. Not all as part of the same work. I mean, obviously, that's why this work is necessary, because it pulls together things that Tolkien wrote to friends, other stories that were unfinished, things that were published as part of the Silmarillion, and kind of brings it all together, looking at the various political entities of Middle-earth, the Elven kingdoms, the human kingdoms, the dwarven kingdoms, and then, of course, the villains, the bad guys, and the various types of rule that we saw in all of these different political entities. Really, really interesting stuff. And even though I'm only on the third chapter in, the human kingdoms of Middle-earth, well, I guess that's the second chapter. The introduction is long enough to count as a chapter by itself, but worth the reading. I can see this is going to be a valuable addition to the library of anybody who's appreciated The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy. Now, of course, I've got to go back and read The Silmarillion and the other works of Tolkien, Unfinished Tales, in order to be able to converse intelligently with Sharon on the Tolkien-esque world. A couple of items in the news this week, and I don't like to, you know, continue beating a horse that's on life support, if not already dead, but I will bring this up once again, because the pointing and shrieking at the state of North Carolina by members of the activist community that are upset by House Bill 2, which is the Public Facilities Safety and Privacy Act, is just mind-numbingly hypocritical. And anyone who looks at the actual facts of the matter and approaches them honestly will come to that conclusion, which, of course, is my whole point, that the activists who are threatening economic blackmail against the state of North Carolina are not looking at this rationally or honestly. Because, as I have mentioned on Skywatch TV, I don't know if I've done it on this program, but on Skywatch TV, I've talked about the, and maybe I have done it here. The hypocrisy is just astonishing. But it is, of course, a sign of the times in which we live. We Christians and social conservatives should expect more of this in the years ahead. Jesus warned us it was coming, so we shouldn't be so surprised. I shouldn't be so surprised. But the economic blackmail by the likes of PayPal, which says we just can't do business in this, in this state. So they stop plans for expanding a global operations center, which costs something like 400 jobs for North Carolinians. Deutsche Bank, which we will not expand operations in the city of Raleigh, a couple hundred more jobs. But when you look at PayPal doing business in 25 different nations that are under Sharia law, well, that's just a little bit hypocritical. And Deutsche Bank, which proudly advertises that it is a leader in global Sharia finance, just a bit hypocritical. Because HB2 in North Carolina, the so-called bathroom bill, it does not prohibit any business owner who have restrooms open to the public from declaring that our restrooms are open to transgender. So if you're a man who feels like a woman, feel free to use the women's room. And of course, the Target stores announced this week that they are going to do that at all their stores around the country. So if you shop at Target with your wife or daughter, men, you might want to take that into account. There's nothing in HB2 that prevents PayPal or Deutsche Bank from saying that in our new facilities here in Charlotte or Raleigh, we will make our restrooms open to whatever gender you happen to feel like today, male, female, or custom. But essentially what North Carolina has done, the legislature has actually put into law a very basic principle of liberty, letting the owners of private property determine how best to serve their customers. If the owner of a restaurant wants to open the bathrooms to everybody, the restrooms to everybody, well, that's fine. Let them. But if, for example, the owner of a health club decides that his clientele, female clientele, would be really, really uncomfortable if some big hairy guy wearing a dress walks into the changing room, the showers, then he should have the right under the law to say, no, you can't do that. You have to use the facility that corresponds to your biological sex. And all HB2 does is say that there is no protection under the law for somebody who insists on using the restroom, the facilities that he feels like using, or she feels like using for that matter. That's all that the law says. Does not prohibit the owner of a business from doing whatever they want. So PayPal, Deutsche Bank, hypocrites, you're more than welcome in North Carolina to open your facilities to whatever gender anybody happens to feel like. But LGBT activists aren't satisfied with that. They want to compel everyone to agree with their particular worldview. Which is, in fact, and again, this is not just hypocritical, it's really ironic. And of course, I don't know if I mentioned that, was it Cirque du Soleil, canceling performances in North Carolina, whereas they are continuing with their scheduled performance in the United Arab Emirates, where it's illegal for gays to marry, adopt children, serve in the military, and they can be punished for breaking any of those laws with fines, imprisonment, or death. So, okay, it's okay if we want to kill gay people. We'll go ahead and perform for you, but you North Carolinians who don't want to let men who say they're women use public restrooms for women, you're just too awful for us to even cross the state line. It is mind-numbingly hypocritical. And of course, the irony is that the way the LGBT community is approaching this, with their point and shriek condemnation of the state of North Carolina, they're really encouraging a fascist system in which government is joined at the hip at business and basically dictates what business must do. Contrary to the way it's portrayed in the media, by the way, fascism is really a left-wing, progressive political system, not a true conservative, limited government type of political system. It makes your head want to explode. It truly does. But again, as a Christian, this is the way the world is going. And each day that we go further down this path, just a day closer, that our redemption draweth nigh. So give thanks for that. Next week, we're going to talk to Stan Deo. Been a rash of major earthquakes around the planet recently, and other people have been noticing things that Stan has been talking about for a long time, about how earthquakes seem to appear at points on the Earth that correspond to a point on the opposite side of the planet, if you draw a line through the core. So just try to get some expertise from somebody who's been watching this for a long, long time. Stan Dale on Our Quaking Earth, and maybe we can get him to share a hint or two about the presentation that he's working on for the upcoming Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. I mean, in 2014, he made a strong case for finding the location of the Garden of Eden in Tanzania, if you recall. I hadn't expected that, but he made a good, strong case. What can he do to come close to that, much less top it? Maybe we can persuade him to drop a hint. That'll be coming up on May 8th on A View from the Bunker. We're really proud of our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship. Sharon and I, well, maybe proud's not the right word, but Sharon and I are finding it to be very, very fulfilling. And we've received a number of emails from people asking, are you going to start producing PID radio more frequently? Probably not, to be honest with you. We're really busy at Skywatch TV, and a lot of what we would have discussed on PID radio is what we bring to the Sci Friday video each week. So there's that. But then 2 hours of Bible study on Sunday each week, 1 hour of New Testament, 1 hour of Old Testament, and we're really getting a lot out of that. So I encourage you to check it out. You'll find the links to the studies going all the way back to number one at gilberthouse.org. Next week on Skywatch TV, we begin 5 weeks of fascinating programs. Steve Quayle joins us for 2 weeks, and then 3 weeks with Chris Putnam and Tom Horn. And this is all related to the release of Chris and Tom's new book. It's the fourth in the series that began with Petrus Romanus, was followed, of course, by Exo Vaticana and On the Path of the Immortals last year. The new book, which is coming at the end of May, is The Final Roman Emperor, The Islamic Antichrist, and The Vatican's Last Crusade. Steve has a new video out, an entry in the documentary series True Legends called The Unholy See, which is about the Vatican and its active participation in what you can only call a cover-up of the evidence of pre-flood civilizations and technology. Why would they do that? So Steve Quayle for 2 weeks, and then Tom Horn, Chris Putnam for 3, coming up on Skywatch TV. It's available multiple times per week. You can get a complete list of channels and times at skywatchtv.com. In the top menu bar there is a link that says channel listing, and you'll find the schedule there. Of course, it's available every Monday morning, the new episode on our Skywatch TV Roku channel. So if you've got a Roku box and you've not yet subscribed to the Skywatch TV channel, go to the menu store in your Roku account online, add the channel, and then you can watch the program before anybody else and watch it at your convenience. We appreciate your reviews of A View from the Bunker on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to find us. And of course, if you want to discuss the issues we talk about here on A View from the Bunker, do that at the View from the Bunker page on Facebook. And while you're there, appreciate you giving us a like, because I got to catch up with Josh Peck and the Sharpening Report. He's way ahead. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme, Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.